Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. As always, you should get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. And we start out by looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. This week, I'd like to start with a letter from Professor Elizabeth Warren, who is spearheading the federal legislation for Consumer Financial Protection Agency to help basically all the rest of the Americans who aren't controlling the money. And this letter went out on her blog, and it said, "Friends, the story of the financial crisis has a thousand twists and turns, but the basic narrative is easy to follow. The financial industry wrote rules that allowed it to act recklessly. The industry captured agencies that were supposed to regulate it, taking cops off the beat and funneling enormous resources into the political process to make sure there wouldn't be any new cops. Then, with no laws to hold them back, the banks made hundreds of billions of dollars on the sales of deceptive products. That went on for years, and the industry's tricks and traps pricing got more and more out of control. Eventually, the sale and resale of deceptive mortgages and other dangerous products made trillions of dollars for Wall Street while bringing down the American economy. When the industry's recklessness brought the biggest banks to the brink of collapse, Wall Street turned to the taxpayers for bailouts and guarantees, which put it right back into big profits and big bonuses. The industry got whatever it wanted. Now we are coming to the final chapter of this story. The final chapter will show whether we are going to let the industry continue to write the rules to keep the cops off the beat, or whether the financial crisis actually changed something. The fate of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency will be the best way to follow the story moving forward, because consumer products were the most abusive and because the CFPA has real muscle to stop those abuses. The CFPA would hire new cops and change the way big banks do business. We have all worked hard to make the CFPA into a reality, and the next few weeks will determine whether our hard work will make a difference for families or whether families will lose once again. The next few weeks will determine whether families will have to play by rules written by the banks and for the banks, rules that let the industry get away with anything. In my view, we cannot let families lose again. Like you, I read last week that the consumer agency is dead. I also read the same thing last spring, last summer, last fall, and last month. And I've been warned about the power of the banks since I first developed this idea in 2007. We always knew this was a David versus Goliath fight, but I don't believe that Washington can or will let Wall Street act like nothing has changed. I'm writing to ask you to make an extra effort these next few weeks to organize calls and emails into the Senate Banking Committee about CFPA, to organize op-ed and letter to the editor campaigns across the country, and to create visible public support for CFPA. If everyone called key senators on the Senate Banking Committee, that would send a loud message. And if your members will do the same, the message will get louder. This is not the last important moment in the fight for the CFPA, but it is a critical one. You can count on me to do my part. Please help. Signed, Elizabeth Warren, who is also the originator of the idea for the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Next, I'd like to go over some basic rules from attorney Max Gardner, who is a super bankruptcy lawyer from North Carolina. He calls it the 10 Consumer Commandments. And if you follow them, you would have fewer hassles and reduce your chances of falling for a scam. Number one, thou shalt not assume. Many consumer problems are created by simple misunderstandings that result in major problems. The best way to keep this from happening is to ask lots of questions. Don't assume the tree service you hire to prune will haul away the debris. Ask. Don't assume the appliance store will remove the old refrigerator when it drops off the new one. Ask. Don't assume you can return that new computer you're about to buy. If the return policy isn't posted, ask. Number two, thou shalt get all promises in writing. If it isn't written down, it doesn't count. Verbal promises are worthless because you can never prove what was said. If there's a dispute, it's your word against theirs, and you have nothing to back up your claim. So, when a mortgage broker says that the bad loan will be refinanced in 6 months, get it in writing and make it part of the original agreement. Or better yet, just reject this type of offer. Number three, thou shalt do thy homework before making a major purchase. We're all racing around trying to do more in a day that is humanly possible. But you can't rush the purchase of a big ticket item such as a household appliance. Take the time to research various brands and models. Read expert reviews and go online to see what customers have to say. Talk to friends and neighbors who have the models you're considering. Use shopping bots to compare prices. The more you know before you head to the store, the more likely you are to get a good deal on the right product. Commandment number four, thou shalt not be penny wise and pound foolish. Cheaper is not always better. Sometimes you save money in the long run by paying a bit more up front. This applies to both products and services. You might pay more for a washing machine that is well built and reliable, but over the long run, you'll have fewer hassles and smaller repair bills. When hiring a contractor, the lowest bidder is not always the best choice. Your goal is to find a reputable company with a good track record, one that will do a good job at a reasonable price. Commandment number five, thou shalt not hire a contractor who just shows up at the door. They'll offer you a great deal on a new roof or new windows or driveway repair because they're in the neighborhood and have materials left over from a previous job. Reputable contractors just don't work that way. The Better Business Bureau website, www.bbb.org, has some great tips as well. The best advice is just to say no thanks. Rule number six. Thou shalt not be pressured into buying anything. A good business doesn't need to rush you into a decision. The high-pressure buy-now approach is designed to keep you from comparison shopping. Don't fall for it. If the salesperson tells you the price won't be good if you walk out the door, turn around and leave. And it is always a good idea to fully check out your new car online and decide exactly what you want and what the approximate dealer's cost is before you ever go to the car lot. Come in prepared to ask for what you want and take control of the situation. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I've been going over the 10 Consumer Commandments by bankruptcy attorney Max Gardner from North Carolina. The seventh commandment is, thou shalt not assume a transaction can be undone. It is amazing how many people think they can buy a car or some other expensive product, use it for a few days, and bring it back if they don't like it. They think everything is covered by the federal government's 3-day cooling off rule. Most purchases are not. That cooling off rule only applies to sales of $25 or more that take place at your home or away from the company's normal place of business. Some states have their own cooling off periods for timeshare, health club, or campground purchases. There is also a notice period on the refinance of a residential mortgage. The cooling off rule, when and how to cancel a sale, can be found on www.ftc.gov, but generally the transaction cannot be undone. Number 8 is, thou shalt not buy a used car without an inspection. A mechanic can spot structural problems, odometer fraud, and flood damage, things that won't necessarily show up on a Carfax report. Yes, you'll pay $100 or so to have this done, but it's worth the money. It is amazing many people have a used vehicle inspected after they buy it. They think if they find a problem, they can get the dealer to fix it for free. Wrong. Most used car sales are as is, where is, and how is, without any warranties. But buy that vehicle, and in most cases, you are stuck dealing with those mechanical problems. That's why you want to have the inspection done before you sign any paperwork. You need to do this even if you're told the dealer inspected the vehicle. The Federal Trade Commission website, again, is www.ftc.gov, and it offers some help. Commandment number 9, thou shalt guard all of your personal information. Keep your private information private. Never give out passwords, PIN codes, or account numbers to an unknown caller, no matter who they claim to be. There's no way you can verify that. Never respond to an email request for personal information, no matter how official it looks or how urgent it sounds. Any company you do business with already has all your personal information and will not send you an email asking for it. When in doubt, contact the company by phone, use the number you know to be legitimate, and ask them what's up. Always shred financial statements and records before throwing them out. The FTC website, www.ftc.gov, offers ways to fight back. And finally, commandment number 10, thou shalt be more skeptical. We've all heard consumer advocates say, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. The expression has become cliche, but the advice is rock solid. If more people would follow this rule, we could actually put a dent in consumer fraud. With most scams, the warning signs are there. We just tend to ignore them. We let greed and gullibility replace common sense. Don't give your hard-earned money to a con artist. Remember these rules. You can't win a contest or lottery you didn't enter, even if the prize-winning notice says you did. If it's a prize, it's yours for free. You don't have to pay any money for anything or give out your credit card number. You can't make lots of money doing virtually no work on a part-time basis. You never have to pay money up front for a credit card or a loan. No one can guarantee you a credit card despite your credit history. And finally, no one in Africa wants to give you $5 million to help you process the money of a deceased family member. So those were the 10 Consumer Commandments by O. Max Gardner, super bankruptcy lawyer from North Carolina.
And for the second segment of the show, I'm continuing to teach from The Two Income Trap, which is by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. And essentially, it is why middle class parents are going broke. providing solutions to that unfortunate circumstance. I'd like to start out with a credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also go to www.kruufm.com, look in the archives under Life and Debt, and listen to all of the programs that have been produced to help you deal with debt issues. The point that I left last week discussing was looking at the modern day couple where both people are working and the myth that they're having problems financially because of the fact that they were overconsuming. But if you actually look at the standard economic reality of the two income earning family, they are vulnerable mostly because they made long-term commitments to what most would consider sensible family purchases, such as housing, education, and health insurance. In fact, it's ironic, but they probably would be more secure financially if they had taken the second earning of the wife and whooped it off on consumables such as flat screen TVs and trips to the Bahamas, because those purchases do not require an ongoing financial commitment, and then the second income is in fact a safety net if something were to happen to the first income. If the modern family where both people are working had saved one income, locking it up for a rainy day, we still have to see the reality of that setup. Money in the bank is great, but so are college degrees, decent medical care, and homes in good school districts, which is why people spent that money. For this kind of couple, looking in the face of the overconsumption critics and the financial planners, they would say, what would be the point of working if we couldn't spend the money to buy better lives for our children? Modern parents aren't sending their kids to daycare every day just so they could go on a cruise or plan some glorious retirement for themselves. Cash savings, money for retirement, treats, and vacations, most people feel come later. Many, many couples decided that their children needed a good home now, good daycare now, and good health insurance now. And a fair number of financial analysts would agree with them about this analysis. So we have to ask, how did families get sucked into the two-income trap? According to Professor Warren, the answer is unexpectedly simple. No one saw it coming. She said that the politics that surrounded women's collective decision to migrate into the workforce are, in fact, a study in misdirection. On the left, the women's movement was battling for equal pay and equal opportunity, and any suggestion that the family might be better off with mother at home was discounted as reactionary chauvinism. On the right, conservative commentators accused working mothers of everything from child abandonment to defying the laws of nature. Professor Warren said that the atmosphere was far too charged for any rational assessment of the financial consequences of sending both spouses into the workforce. Her conclusion is that the massive miscalculation ensued because both sides of the political spectrum discounted the financial value of the stay-at-home mother. And I'll get into this in a minute. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we're talking about the two-income trap and currently how families got sucked into it. I just left with the thought that the massive miscalculation came up because both sides of the political spectrum had discounted the financial value of the stay-at-home mother. The right-wingers were saying that working mothers amounted to child abandonment or defying the laws of nature, whereas the left-wing commentators were suggesting that mothers at home was discounted as reactionary chauvinism. As I mentioned, Professor Warren disagreed and called this a massive miscalculation because of the financial value of the stay-at-home mother. No one really looked at that. She says, feminist leader Betty Friedan scoffed at the economic role of the homemaker. The really important role that women serve as housewives is to buy more things for the house. Somehow, somewhere, someone must have figured out that women will buy more things if they are kept in the underused, nameless yearning, energy to get rid of state of being housewives. Feminists assume that women's entry into the workforce entailed no real costs, only benefits. On the other hand, conservatives, for their part, slavishly touted the emotional benefits for the stay-at-home mother, which she provides to her children, and fretted over who will rock the cradle when mothers abandon their homes. Professor Warren said that there was no room in either worldview for the capable, resourceful mother, who might spend her days devoted to the roles of wife and mother, but who could, if necessary, rise to the occasion and dive headlong into the workforce to support her family. No one saw the stay-at-home mom as the family's safety net, and that's a very important underlying principle here. It was easy for the family to see income going up, but it was very hard to foresee what would happen if something went wrong. When most families plan their futures and pencil in their budgets, they concentrate on what is most immediate. They look at the paychecks coming in, the mortgage going out, the month-to-month fluctuations in the checking account, and so on and so forth. Except for disquieting moments when they take out a life insurance policy or learn that a friend has lost his job, most don't notice the growing vulnerability that has seeped into their lives and stolen their security, particularly in an unchallenged economy. But the truth that those disquieting moments are even more frequent in an economy such as we have today. So it was all good intentions that created this kind of setup for the two-income trap. Professor Warren asked then the question about turning back the clock. She says, must mothers give up their jobs and head back home if they are to escape the two-income trap? She says, actually, she and her daughter are two working mothers and confess to a deep resistance to calling for a move to go back into the home. She says that she and Amelia remain dedicated to the best part of the feminist movement, the rock-solid belief that women who want to work should have every opportunity to do so, but personal politics aren't the point. A mass exodus from the workplace to home is about as likely as the revival of the horse-drawn buggy. Social and political forces have changed the shape of women's expectations and their role within the family. There's new information about the macroeconomic implications of their entry into the workforce, which is unlikely to change much. Even if women listened hard to those admonishing them to remain at home, most nowadays cannot do it. Why? Such advice really ignores the fact that families are caught in a trap. Any individual family that chooses to drop down to one income will be immediately penalized, while those who keep both parents in the workforce will gain a strategic advantage. Those families may understand that living on two incomes increases their risk of economic collapse, but risks dwell in the future, and the kids have needs that must be met today. Besides, in many families, it is far too late to contemplate pulling mom out of the workforce. For millions of parents who have already committed mom's income to the mortgage and car payments and other substantial contracts for necessaries, the time for such second thoughts is really long past. If she were to leave her job, these families would stand to lose everything. Professor Warren and Amelia say there is a better path out of the two-income trap. That is, give families some breathing room. They say that as befits a society in which the safety net must be built one family at a time, money in the bank is still the first line of defense against any economic bump in the road. Any program that helps families save money is a program that helps keep the middle class secure. The federal government offers a handful of programs that give tax breaks to families who put money aside for specific expenses, such as retirement, medical care, or college tuition, for example. These programs certainly sound promising, but they ask families to do something that is almost impossible in a capricious world. They ask them to predict the unpredictable. To take advantage of these programs, families need to know how in advance which expenses will hit them and when they will need extra cash. In other words, what happens when an unforeseen disaster strikes? When dad loses his job, or when mom asks for a divorce. Families all face events that elude that kind of careful planning. Professor Warren holds that the first line of defense is their all-purpose passbook savings account, an account that is tax disadvantaged. If things get really bad, many families find that the only way to survive is to cash out their retirement accounts. The huge penalty associated with that withdrawal set in place as a disincentive to withdraw early doubles the pain. Not only has the family just wiped out any chance for a comfortable retirement, the government just took a huge hunk of their only savings at a time when the family was already under extreme financial stress. Now, if the standard government policies were turned sideways, instead of asking each family to carve its nest egg into separate little tax advantage slices, middle-class families could be rewarded for all savings. All savings, not just specifically designated for retirement or education, should be exempt from taxes. Many liberals have opposed such a change for fear that it would disproportionately benefit the wealthy, who are the only ones with ample savings, but this concern could be easily remedied. The tax change could be implemented on a sliding scale so that those with modest means could save tax-free while the wealthy continue to be taxed, or the government could compensate for the lost tax revenues by increasing other taxes on well-to-do households. The fear of letting the rich off too easy should not overshadow the fact that middle-class families desperately need to build their own safety nets. America's personal savings rate has plummeted in the past 30 years so that it now stands effectively at zero, or as has been quoted in the last several years, below zero. Encouraging savings shouldn't be about token programs for one or two specified uses. It should be a concerted government policy aimed at helping families build safety nets strong enough to see them through good times and bad. Over the past generation, the two-income trap has left the modern family in a position that is thick with irony. Today's parents are working harder than ever, far harder than their single-income counterparts of a generation ago, holding down full-time paying jobs and still covering all their obligations at home. Yet, paradoxically, without the safety net once provided by the stay-at-home mother, they are more vulnerable to financial disaster. They have little money left to build their own safety nets, and government policies tax most of their efforts to provide for themselves. They are caught, can't afford to work, can't afford to quit, and can't survive if something goes wrong. If the risks of the world had remained exactly the same over the past generation, the same risk of getting laid off, the same odds of getting divorced, the same chance that grandmother would grow too old or too frail to live without assistance, then the two-income trap would have imposed a moderate dose of hardship on American families as they struggled to survive in hard times. But the risks of the world did not stay the same. Families lost the stay-at-home mother just when they needed her most. And we will continue this discussion next week with the myth of the immoral debtor. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable.